Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, imagine traveling to a land where compassion and inclusion abound. Well, in our first segment, we're going to meet the three creative minds who brought the new children's book, Soulful Sydney Explores Diversity to Life, and discover why it was so important for each of them to create characters kids can relate to, and why discovering someone different should be celebrated, not feared. Then we're going to sit down to a conversational feast with Dr. Dina Rose, who was among the prestigious presenters at Yale's recent Mediterranean Diet Roundtable. We're going to hear about how she's educating parents and caregivers of kids who are difficult eaters with her sensory-based Super Food Explorer Kit, which can help children discover new foods and habits by exploring their food with all of their senses. Then we're going to close touching base with the CEO of the Center for Family Justice, which provides free and confidential trauma-informed services and coordinates care for victims and survivors of domestic violence, sexual abuse, human trafficking, and child abuse. And we'll invite you out to the agency's 21st annual Speaking of Women event coming up in September. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this invitation. Hey, bounce down to Fairfield University on Friday, July 27th for Will Weinbach's Celebrity Basketball Game. Founded in 2018 by Will Weinbach, this event brings together the most established athletes, artists, and executives to raise money for the Connecticut Special Olympics and the Fairfield Police Scholarship Fund. You'll have a chance of winning a brand new Chevrolet with a half-court shot, so get your tickets now and find out more by clicking on celebhoops.com.
Well, we talk about books once in a while on the program, but never have I really been so instantly inspired as I have when I first glanced on the cover of a book called Soulful Sydney Explores Diversity. And I am so pleased to have all three of the authors here today. Miriam Aziz, Terry Murphy, and Deborah Clark are all involved with the project. So who gets to tell me whose idea it was? Miriam?
It was actually Terry's idea. She created the Soulful Sydney with her friend Christina Connors a few years back. But then Sydney was born, and then it all just came together.
And how did they find you?
So 2 years ago, Terry needed something from the mosque, and she was sort of scared of Muslims. So she went with my mom, actually, and then she thought, well, maybe they're not so bad. So she went to the mosque, and she saw all the children, and she really liked them, and she met me there. And then 2 years later, she needed help with a book about a Muslim girl. So she asked who can help me write this, and I was just like, okay, let me give it a shot. And then I raised my hand, and that's how we got together.
Tell me about what brought you to the mosque with Miriam's mom for the first time.
I actually needed a favor from somebody in the Islamic community. And I went there and I was greeted with, and I would encourage anybody to just go to your neighborhood mosque and ask questions and say, hello, my name is. And I have found tremendous friendships there. It's been wonderful.
Mm-hmm. So tell me more about the inception of this project and kind of bringing it to the point where you're all collaborating together.
Well, I have a reputation for writing poetry, rhyming poetry. And when Terry, I've done it for years, ever since I was a little girl, I've written
like... Published or just for your own
mostly
enjoyment?
Mostly just for my own enjoyment. And the entertainment of family, friends, colleagues. Oh, I've written poems for people for birthdays, retirements, former students that I had.
Sure.
I was an English teacher for 40 years. So my interest in poetry is pretty well ingrained.
Yep.
And when Terry got started on this particular project... And she and Miriam had written a rough draft. She contacted me. She said, Deb, could you help us work this out a little bit more? Because I sort of took it and got the rhythm and the rhymes a little bit more under control.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, and then we back and forth. I live in Maryland, so we really couldn't meet in person. In fact, today is the first time I ever met Miriam in person. But Terry and I talk frequently. We're always on email, and so we just managed to get the whole thing done.
Yes.
One of the things that I've really enjoyed about this is when Deb and I were raised, the values that our parents set for us of kindness and inclusion, it is such a beautiful thing for us to be able to involve the Muslim community and write this book. I think it's timely and I think it's relevant, and we're really, really proud.
Great. So, Miriam, let me go back to you to just kind of let folks know who might be listening to the program, kind of a little bit about the book from your perspective.
The book is about the power of kindness and inclusion. Like Sydney and her dog Max, they live in a neighborhood, and suddenly this new girl moves in next door, and she's Muslim. She wears a hijab, and she's proud of it, but Max doesn't see it. He doesn't really understand it. So he embodies the fear inside of everyone, but later he realizes that it's not what's on you that matters. It's what inside of you. It's inside of your heart. And so he finally realizes it, and in the end he's sitting on her lap as a symbol of trust and love. So it all works out in the end. They are the three friends who bring hope, and they find diversity. They find that there's a place for everybody where they can live in harmony and peace.
How many steps in the process of your involvement in this book were you able to relate to your own personal experience or draw from things that you heard about or saw, whether it was on CNN or in your own neighborhood?
Well, when I was in kindergarten, I sort of got bullied because I was Muslim. Like, a kid on the bus threatened me. He said he would take a knife and stab me. So my mom, she got scared, and I wasn't really learning that much in school, so she decided to homeschool me out of fear. And she actually didn't want me to wear the hijab. I started in March because she was scared. She's like, people could hurt you. But I said, no, I'm gonna wear it. You can't stop me. And it also, I can relate to it because my brothers, they were also bullied. A guy, he said in the fifth, he was sixth grader or fifth grader, and my brother's just a fourth grader. On the bus, he said he's going to bring a knife and he was going to shoot him.
Yeah, right.
And so my mom, she got scared because his parents were like racist. So she didn't know. She called the police. He was threatening my brother. And they found that there was a gun in this kid's house. That it was not protected, it was not secure. He could have brought in on the bus, he could have shot my brother. And luckily my mom did not press charges, but this is scary. And many Muslims in high school, they're being bullied. Like my brothers, he said that my mom and dad were... He said there's a lot of things. It's not just my brothers. It's also other kids. And it's not just Muslims. It's also it's non-Muslims. It's blacks. It's Hispanic people. It's everybody that's being discriminated against, the vulnerable communities.
Yeah, yeah.
So we want to let people who are like Max, sort of, like, that are ill-informed, we want them to be formed with right knowledge, and that is through power of kindness and inclusion.
Right. So, Terry and Deborah, tell me a little about your own experiences that kind of brought you to this project and brought it to fruition.
I'm a grandma, and I really want to create a soulful forest for my grandkids to live in, someplace that is inclusive, a gratitude garden, a field of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And it was from that desire to create that for my grandkids that that I created Sydney's Soulful Adventures.
Mm-hmm.
I was a high school English teacher for 40 years, and I encountered many children from many different backgrounds. And as Terry mentioned earlier, our parents raised us to be all-inclusive and kind and compassionate toward everyone. And so that's how... And as she mentioned, I'm also a grandmother, and I want to see my grandchildren grow up in a world that is kinder and more peaceful. Like Terry befriended some people from the mosque, I befriended a whole group of a whole family from Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
And when the children first came to the school, they spoke nothing but Chinese, but somehow we managed to communicate, and I got to be good friends with their family. And through it all, I remembered the lessons that we learned as children to be kind and inclusive of everyone. And we had friends growing up from all different backgrounds, to the point where we even had a neighbor one time who didn't like some of the friends that we had at our house. So this is our way of kind of giving back to the world.
And from your perspective, having actually immersed yourself in a kind of impromptu relationship with people from a different culture, what is the message that you would like to share, whether it's rooted in the book or not, with people that might be listening to the program who have a very limited or kind of superficial experience with folks who are completely removed from the American thing?
I think that in the climate that we have, not just in our own country, but worldwide today, people need to try to reach out and get past their prejudices and come to some kind of a feeling of togetherness and realize that being at odds with other people because you don't understand their culture or their religion or their background is not going to promote peace and unity of any kind.
And being scared is kind of stupid, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what are the reactions of people your age or even younger who are reading the book? Are you having an opportunity to have some of either your friends or total strangers who are you know, kids read the book?
So far, anybody who has read the book really liked it. Like, my friends got back to me, they really liked it. And because it doesn't promote things as in a way like, we'll get rid of these people by not letting them in. We'll let them in, and that's how we don't make them those people, we make them us people. So there's, like, no differences. And children, they don't have filtered minds like adults. They see him as, like, oh, you're not invited to my birthday party. And then 5 seconds later, they're playing again.
Yeah.
So adults, they're sort of like, who is she? Why does she do this? If I have to protect my family, I'll do something against her. I don't like the way she looks. Why is she like that? She could be holding a bomb. I have to be ready for this. And the children are just like, oh, wow, I like your hair. It's pretty.
So for our last co-author, Terry, how about you? Reactions to the book from your circle of friends or total strangers who have had the opportunity to see it?
Well, I feel like I've become famous and popular, which I really wasn't in high school, so this is really fun for me. I'm having a good time. It's such a great book. The response has been amazing. Bookstores are asking us to do signings, and interfaith agencies. I'm just really excited. This is a fantastic experience. I love the book. Thank you.
Excellent. Great to meet you guys. Thanks for coming. We are at the book launch here for Soulful Sydney Explores Diversity with Miriam Aziz, Terry Murphy, and Deborah Clark, the co-authors of this book. Perhaps you'll be seeing it included in one of your school curriculums, or if you are a homeschooler, maybe it's something you want to add to your child's reading list, whether they are pre-K or I do imagine there may be something that could be offered to someone as old as high school age. In looking at this book, the message is excellent, and our authors are really, really fabulous. Great pleasure to be here at this book signing party for Soulful Sydney Explores Diversity.
So as we mentioned in the introduction, a couple of weeks ago, the Mediterranean Diet Roundtable, or the MDR, rolled out its fourth edition. This is one of the most exciting events in the food industry, and the ability for attendees who came to Yale University a couple weeks ago to taste and learn about products distinctive of the Mediterranean diet while networking and getting inspired featured the presence of the person that we're going to be talking to for the next 15 or 18 minutes. I'm so pleased to welcome Dr. Dina Rose to the program. She has been a sociologist. She's a parent educator, a feeding expert, and the author of It's Not About Broccoli, 3 Habits to Teach Your Kids for a Lifetime of Healthy Eating. So, Dr. Rose, thank you so much for being part of the program.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
So this is really exciting. I did want to spend a few minutes just kind of looking back on this Mediterranean Diet Roundtable as an event. Tell me a little bit about your reflections of it, and do you think it played an important role in sort of advancing the kind of things that you're trying to do in your professional world?
You know, it was a terrific conference of people coming together, and I just want to also say the food, oh my goodness, the food was excellent. So that was a treat. You know, this was a conference for like-minded people, I think. So it was a little bit of preaching to the choir about the advances in the science around the Mediterranean diet and the benefits of the Mediterranean diet. But I think that it was really terrific to see all the different ways in which people are working on and looking into how the diet works. My particular perspective was to think about how we can implement it and teach children and adults, of course, how to enjoy a different set of flavors than maybe that they're used to. So I feel like we heard from people who talked about what it is. We talked about people, you know, we heard from people who said, you know, why it is and then how to do it. So I just thought it was a comprehensive look at the Mediterranean diet, and I certainly enjoyed being there.
Mm. You had a couple folks who were colleagues in the event who came from Mediterranean countries, Greece and Italy. Were they able to offer you any perspectives? Were there things that you came away from the roundtable armed with that you either didn't know at all before or didn't know much about?
Well, I really enjoyed hearing about how different people in all parts of the world are working on implementing techniques related to the Mediterranean diet. And when the people who were from those countries, you know, told stories, both their sort of historical family stories about eating this way and how there's been changes in those countries in recent years was just really fascinating. And of course, as I said at the top of the interview, you know, and the food, it was great. That was also interesting, too, because I want to say when we think about a Mediterranean diet, we just sort of think about the categories of, you know, heavy on fruits and vegetables and olive oil. But to see the different ways that the flavor profiles can come together just shows that this is not a limited diet, that we might be tempted to think that if we go over to that side in our own diets, shaping the typical American diet, that we're going to be bored. I hear that a lot when people think about increasing fruits and vegetables in their diet. They feel like that would be boring. And it's because we do this sort of mental exercise where we collapse the category. So when we think of, like, you know, cookies, there are hundreds of different kinds of cookies or crackers or whatever. But when we think of fruits and vegetables, we sort of narrow it down in our mind and it becomes, well, just steamed vegetables or something like that. And one of the messages that I have been sort of trying to scream from the rooftops is that if we want people to eat this way, we have to stop talking about how nutritious it is and start talking about how delicious it is. And this conference really showed how you can take fruits and vegetables and prepare them in so many different ways. And I think that's one of the things that everybody came away from this conference really understanding in a much more, it was sort of in a deeper way than just sort of this idea of, oh, well, we should eat steamed asparagus or something like that.
Right. Well, in looking over the massive amount of background information that came to read about both the roundtable and you, a couple of things that stuck out to me were that essentially you don't hit people over the head with nutrition. In fact, there's a statement in one of the talking points, I think, that says nutrition is irrelevant when you're feeding kids.
It really is. Not only, I mean, let's look, you know, at the bigger picture. And of course, we want to eat a nutritious diet and we want our kids to eat a nutritious diet. So in that way, of course, nutrition is relevant. But we all know that carrots are not cookies. And so that's almost all you really need to know. And then the more we talk about nutrition, the more we talk about it as a as medicine. Food is medicine. I was at a conference earlier a few months ago, and that was the message that they were really pushing, is food is medicine. Well, when you tell kids food is medicine, or not even say that out loud, but sort of imply that food is medicine, then kids build up this sort of like, oh my gosh, who wants to eat medicine? And think about it this way, when we start promoting how these foods are healthy and you should eat them because they're healthy, what happens is we sort of abdicate all the yummy words to the junk food. So we say eat spinach because it's loaded with, you know, iron or something like that. And then we say yummy, brownies, chocolatey, creamy, you know, delicious. And so by comparison, we just keep reinforcing this idea that the healthy food is the stuff you got to eat.
Yeah.
And the good stuff is the stuff you want to eat. And so in that regard, nutrition education is not only irrelevant, it can be counterproductive, and the research backs that up.
And I guess skating toward the black ice involves the sort of tried and true, you know, eat what's good for you and then you get a treat. It's like, why can't what's good for you be the treat?
Exactly. So all food should be considered to be a treat. Of course, we all like certain kinds of things a little bit more than others, but we do exactly what you're saying, have to think about all those foods as being really fun and tasty for us to eat. But here's the other problem with, you know, eat the good food, that, you know, the food that's good for you and then you get the treat, is that it reinforces, of course, the conception of what's good and bad, but it also teaches the lesson that you eat dessert on a full stomach instead of, you know, saving room for dessert. It just distorts so many lessons. It makes kids learn to listen to signals outside their body, either the portion size or their parents' voices about how much they should eat. I mean, it just divorces us from the concept of eating habits and what lessons kids need in order to manage eating in a world where there are just so many opportunities to eat incorrectly. So we really have to strip that down and go back to the behaviors that we want them to learn, such as how to put sweets and treats into their diet in a way that works, instead of thinking these are the good foods and those are the bad foods.
Yeah, and there's also what's interesting, Dr. Rose, is there's sort of a socio-political aspect to it as well that involves food justice and food insecurity, isn't there?
Well, I mean, are you talking about sort of like by promoting these foods and then there's not that kind of access in all sorts of neighborhoods? Is that sort of where you're going?
Yeah, there's some challenges there that certain populations may find significantly greater, right?
Yeah, but I'll tell you what the real big issue is when you want people to start changing their habits, is that the less disposable income you have, the less able you are to actually try a dish and then potentially have to throw it out. So when we don't really give parents a low-cost skill, a low-cost technique for exposing their children to different flavors and textures and, you know, food that looks different, when we don't give them a low-cost way of doing that, then we really do tie their hands, because, you know, just think about how aggravating it is for people who have the means to cook and then potentially throw out the food that their kids reject, and then, you know, scale that to a place where you can't afford to do that. So it's not just about access, but it's actually about the ability, the flexibility to do that. We don't give people the tools, and then we condemn them for not being willing to change their habits.
Hmm. And there are so many cultures across the world in very, very, you know, financially challenged, you know, very low income environments, who manage with just a few simple ingredients to create daily meals for their families and their children, and the kids embrace it and love it and clean the plate, and it reflects in their kind of overall health profile.
Well, absolutely, that in traditional diets, right, where there's not the flooded market of manufactured foods or grocery stores that have on average 40,000 different items in them, in a culture where there isn't that kind of plenty, then people are exposed to the kind of flavor profiles and texture profiles of the more traditional diet. But more importantly, they don't have the backup that American parents have to just go into the freezer or the refrigerator and pick another item. Mm. And so although, of course, some amount of picky eating or selective eating or resistance to changing your diet, some of that, of course, is tied to sensory issues or other kinds of real sort of medical issues that children have. The widespread problem that we have in the United States of people, you know, preferring chicken nuggets, that kind of picky eating is really a problem of plenty, because when children really are suffering from hunger or where there is a scarce amount of food, people eat what's put in front of them. And so we have both the plenty and sort of a parenting paradigm in our current environment, which doesn't want kids to ever be hungry, which doesn't want kids to be upset, and which has a lot of stuff in the fridge to fall back on. And so it's both our cultural and socioeconomic status, plus our sort of attitudes towards parenting and all those kinds of things have come together and cause a lot of the problem.
Excellent. Well, folks, we're going to be back after a quick break, but we're talking with sociologist Dr. Dina Rose, who's been talking about kids creating good eating habits by sensory-based food education for more than a decade. She was part of the prestigious Mediterranean Diet Roundtable, a 2.5-day conference that was held at Yale University a couple of weeks ago. So we're going to come right back and talk about her Super Food Explorer kit. Stick with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The Mossman Sprint Triathlon has been a Connecticut Shoreline staple since 2003, and it's back for its 15th year on August 19th. The race consists of a half-mile swim in Long Island Sound, a two-loop, mostly flat, 13.5-mile bike, and 3-mile run through Calf Pasture Beach in Norwalk. This course attracts and is great for all levels of athletes, including top age groupers, elite junior triathletes, and beginners. This year's race benefits the Gaylord Center for Concussion Care. So to learn more about the race and other events put on by Team Mossman Events, visit teammossman.com. That's Team MOSSMAN.com. We also want to remind you that staff from Bridgeport Hospital will join the Get Healthy CT Partners for Family Fitness Day, Saturday, July 28th, from 11 to 2 at Paradise Green in Stratford. This event coincides with National Dance Day and encourages area residents of all ages to be physically active and eat healthy foods. It's going to feature interactive performances by dance studios, fitness demonstrations, and other family-friendly activities, free healthy snacks, prize drawings, and people who attend can buy fresh fruit and vegetables at a pop-up produce market. Admission to Family Fitness Day is free, but residents are asked to bring a healthy food item to donate to Sterling House in Stratford. For a list of those healthy food items and more information on the event, visit gethealthyct.org. All right. Thanks for coming back. We are with Dr. Dina Rose, who just appeared with a number of really esteemed folks from around the world at the Mediterranean Diet Roundtable at Yale University back in late June. Dr. Rose created a sensory-based toolkit called Super Food Explorer Kit. And this is really fun. It's discovering food one poke, rattle, sniff, and slurp at a time. So I think right there, Dr. Rose, you've captured the youth demographic in terms of kids wanting to get a hold of this thing and jump right in. Let's spend the balance of our time together talking a little bit more about this and what you can tell parents and young people and caregivers and grandparents and babysitters that might be listening. That could tap into this plan and really make a positive difference.
Absolutely. So the first thing that I want to say is that when we are thinking about nutrition education, when we're telling children that this has the vitamins or the minerals, we are using an idea that that when you know better, you'll do better, right? So we're appealing to the rational brain that, oh, I ought to eat that. But for people, and especially little people, children, they are eating for, you know, pleasure. They're eating for emotional reasons. And so appealing to their rational mind doesn't really work. Plus, if you've been in a struggle with them, or if they ever gagged, or if they have any other kinds of anxieties, they're bringing a lot of emotions into this dynamic. So the first thing we need to remember is that picky eaters would eat the way you want them to if they could, that they're using techniques that are sort of solving some other problem for them, and that we have to deal with that emotions. We have to rebuild the trust so that they know that we're not trying to make them eat something. Once they know that the eating is off the table and that we're just asking them to look at it, or maybe they're asking them to squeeze it, or roll a pea or squish a pea or smell the pea, then children are much more likely to get involved. And so we need to employ all the senses. So looking at something and describing it is going to be just as useful for a child who can only go that far as maybe taking a lick or a small taste is for a child who can go that far. And so we have to build up their database of food facts. We have to build up their confidence and trust. And employing all the senses is really, really the way to do it. And there's just so many reasons why it works.
We've had a lot of guests on the show going back now probably closer to 20 years or even longer. And I mean, we've broadcast from Farm Aid, where we're talking with folks leading initiatives to do urban gardening. And here in Connecticut, there are a number of both school-based service organization-based and just neighborhood organizations that have community gardens. And they all talk about getting kids involved. I mean, I remember when, in second grade, where we'd put the bean plant in the paper towel, or the bean in the paper towel, and it would grow.
Yeah.
Where do you come down on the effectiveness of learning about food from the point of inception, basically the growing it up first and then taking it from the garden to the plate to the belly?
Well, of course, the more exposure that children have to the entire process, to looking at food in all of its ways and being, tactile with it and getting their hands dirty is going to help. However, the thing that I really want to stress here for parents who have tried that, or parents who have gone grocery shopping with their kids and yet their kid, or cooked with their kids and yet their kids are still not eating better at home, is to say that the success that those programs have is in effect sort of creaming the top. It's taking the kids who are predisposed to already being okay and being adventurous. And maybe it's taking sort of the next a little bit nervous kid and sort of helping that child along. But for kids who are entrenched in the struggle, or who are really, really scared, or have other issues that are preventing them from using those techniques, then we just need to augment it, and we can do the gardening, but then let's put a deliberate sensory exploration activity with it. Because what happens with those activities and why it works, right, is they build on how kids naturally learn. It involves them. It's not sort of this passive, nutrition education is sort of like a classic classroom top down. It's very passive, whereas sensory exploration gets kids involved. And that is how they naturally learn. But the other thing is that we need to start letting them express their reactions and their feelings to what they're being exposed to, and not just in the positive way. So one of the things that parents do that's very well-meaning, teachers do this, it's very well-meaning, which is like the don't yuck on my yum, don't say something is gross because I might like it. And I know that there's two motives for that. One is that we want to teach children basic manners. You don't want them at grandma's house, choking, holding their throats and sort of gagging and falling on the floor.
Please, no more beet salad.
Please. But We also think of a contagion effect, that if one child says yuck, then the next child's going to say yuck. But here's the thing, is that if we only allow the positive reaction, then we're basically telling kids who have a negative reaction, we don't really want to hear from you. And that disenfranchises them from the process, right? They don't want to become involved. And the whole range of reactions has to be acceptable. And so one of the things that we can do to get away from the, sort of thumbs up, thumbs down, is just not ask them if they like something, but ask them what color is it, or what texture is it, or is it salty, or let's rate which one of these items is the crunchiest, or let's predict whether it's going to be soft inside or hard inside, and then we open it up. So we need to change the question that we ask children so that we avoid just the sort of thumbs up, thumbs down, it's good, it's bad. And that helps them learn. But moreover, it helps bring even the ones who are sort of in the yuck land, and those are the ones who we need to work the hardest with, it brings them back into the fold because their feelings, their reactions are being accepted, welcomed, validated, as opposed to just telling them, well, if you don't like this, keep it to yourself.
Hmm. Well, in the last couple minutes that we have with you, Dr. Rose, one of the groups that I constantly am hearing about. I'm hearing about it when I'm sitting adjacent to folks at restaurants. I'm hearing about it in grocery stores. I'm hearing about it from friends who are just like pulling their hair out. What advice or guidance do you have, under the umbrella of your expertise and the information that you have written and provide? What guidance do you have for parents whose children apparently or have diagnosed food allergies?
So, of course, food allergies can be very problematic, but I just want to start by saying that all the recommendations have now switched about exposing children to potentially allergenic foods earlier rather than later. So if you don't know yet, if your kids are still really young, I said, go for it. You're supposed to start exposing them to those things unless you have a reason to think that they have allergies. Once they have allergies, of course, you have to be very careful. But one of the problems that can happen with children who have allergies is that they start to get scared about any kind of new food because they feel unclear about whether or not it's going to be dangerous for them. So one of the things that I recommend for parents to do with their kids is to, depending on their age, maybe start making an arts and crafts project of these are the foods that are all perfectly safe. And so if your kids are not allergic to fruits and vegetables, don't just write the word fruit, but draw a picture or cut out a magazine picture of every kind of fruit, every kind of vegetable, every kind of thing that they're not allergic to, so that they can see what the safe foods are, and then maybe do the same thing with these are the you have to ask mom and dad foods, and then these are the you have to avoid foods. Because allergies are important to deal with, but the unintended consequence is that everybody can get a little shut down about trying new foods. And so we don't want to let allergies rule the entire diet. We just want to make it, the safety concern that it needs to be.
Excellent. Well, first of all, where can folks go to learn more and hear more about what we talked about this morning in relation to your work?
My website is called itsnotaboutnutrition.com, and there are hundreds of articles that I've written about all different aspects of feeding kids. You can sign up for a free 30-minute consultation there. You can purchase the kit. And, of course, you can always purchase my book wherever books are sold. It's called It's Not About the Broccoli, 3 Habits to Teach Your Kids for a Lifetime of Healthy Eating.
Excellent. Dr. Rose believes it's not just talking about nutrition that'll get children to develop healthy relationships with food, that it's habits and teaching children how to eat right. So pleased to meet you, Dr. Dina Rose. She was recently one of the folks in at Yale for the Mediterranean Diet Roundtable. And it was just fantastic to speak with you, Dr. Rose. And I hope you'll join us again to talk a little bit more. When's the next book coming? Come on.
That's a tightly held secret.
Okay, great. Well, we'll look for it, and then we're going to have you back. So thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, we've started on location with our three authors, and then we went to the phone to talk with Dr. Rose, and now we're sort of finishing off with a perfect trinity here because we have a guest in studio, something that's become a little bit more rare here on the award-winning For the People, and it's a great pleasure to welcome back an old friend and really someone who was a fairly regular guest on the program, and we determined that it's been far too long since we talked about the Center for Family Justice. President and CEO of that organization, Deborah Greenwood, is here. Deb spent really 3.5 decades in nonprofit management, and she does strategic planning, fundraising, community mobilization, leadership, program development. But right now, we are going to be talking about the Center for Family Justice, and we want you to put a date on your calendar. That's September 25th because it's the 21st annual Speaking of Women Conference in Monroe. We'll be talking about that as well with Deb Greenwood. Deb, good to see you. Thanks for coming, and sorry it's been so long since we talked.
Thanks for having me, John. Appreciate it.
So let's start catching up. What's happening these days? What's the hot item on your plate right now at the Center for Family Justice?
Well, as we became the first family justice center in the state of Connecticut, that was in 2016, we've pretty much tripled the amount of people coming through our doors that are victims of abuse, whether they have been affected by domestic violence, sexual violence, and we, in addition to that, work with a lot of children under the age of 18 years old that have been affected by abuse. So one of the, I guess, second first for us also happened in 2017. That was starting a legal incubator program where victims of abuse that need legal services to represent them in court also became part of our facility at 753 Fairfield Avenue in Bridgeport. And right behind that, we had about 18 months to also be chosen as one of 16 sites in the United States to launch and pilot something called Camp Hope Connecticut, working with children that have been affected by trauma and abuse, whether, again, sexual violence or living in a severe physical abusive home. And we actually had our first season last summer, and we do this in collaboration with the Central Connecticut Coast YMCA using Camp High Rock, which is a sleepaway camp up in the Berkshires. And this summer, actually this Sunday, we send off another group of children. We've doubled the amount of kids we're taking up there this summer. So 48 kids from the greater Bridgeport area will go, no fee attached, but will have a specialized camp that works on the trauma that they've endured while they've been a victim of abuse. So we've been extremely busy, but our focus is working now also in addition with adults, with kids.
Excellent. Well, that is today as we broadcast on Sunday morning. So perhaps folks will be listening to this either on their way to the departure zone for the camp, or they'll be maybe listening to it on their way up to the camp. So that's fabulous. So a couple of the really important statistics that folks need to be aware of is a couple of times a day, year round, 365 days a year, your agency is responding to survivors of sexual assault or their families. And probably about three times a day, you're getting calls to the 24-hour crisis line. So this is really something that keeps the Center for Family Justice and your volunteers and staff on their toes, because, you know, when it adds up, it's a big number. But this is something that that could come at you any moment of any day.
It absolutely could, John. The region that we serve, which primarily is Bridgeport, Easton, Fairfield, Monroe, Stratford, and Trumbull, has logged in 3,661 victims of abuse, all ages, from children, again, to elder abuse. And those are unduplicated numbers. So if you take that and you look at now with the Justice Center having all services under one roof, you could probably multiply that by 3 to 5 times. But on an average across the country, a victim of abuse will go through the system of domestic and sexual violence 7 to 10 times. And why we reduce the number now at the Justice Center is because we have the additional services past the crisis, working with law enforcement that are in our building, having programs like support groups, having a 24/7 hotline where if a client has come through and something has happened after they've talked to one of our counselors, they can still access that hotline at any hour of the day, 365 days a year. And after crisis, now we can take them into self-sufficiency. By that meaning, how can I now move past the crisis? How can I get on my feet? How can I support myself? How can I support myself and my children? How can I find a job? So we have at the Center for Family Justice an empowerment room where individuals will come in to learn how to write a resume, how to find different varieties of jobs, how to move on with their educational support, whether it's getting a GED or starting a career at a community college, or possibly had interruption during their experience where they didn't finish their college degree. So it's been an incredible journey to watch in the last 2 years of how our victims now become survivors.
Mm. And also, people, I think, would be very interested to know that the Center for Family Justice is actually part of the investigative team when these cases come to law enforcement, social services, the judicial system. Tell us the role that the Center for Family Justice plays in the investigations, and how having sort of the foot in the law enforcement judicial end and the foot in the support and the service delivery end really end up combining to provide relief and effective outcomes for the people that you work with?
That is a great question. Again, Wes, we've really expanded and utilizing a lot of nonprofits in our area in Bridgeport that have expertise, whether that is, again, working with law enforcement, a significant partner of a justice center and our agency. When a child will look at a child that has disclosed that they've been abused, whatever that means to them, again, inappropriate touch, teachers, camp counselors are all mandated reporters. So the journey begins. Law enforcement gets a phone call. DCF can get a phone call. But we are also a National Children's Alliance or Children's Advocacy Center. In addition to working with the adults, we are one of 9 agencies that have in our building a very child-friendly suite in the building where our unit, which is really 2 full-time staff, one that is bilingual and the other who works with law enforcement, also leads this this program, which is called the MDT, a long name for a multi-interdisciplinary team. This effective team is made up of our staff, DCF, Yale's Children's Pediatric Unit, where forensic nurses do the non-invasive examination of a child if it's been sexual assault. Bridgeport Hospital has an area that in the last 2 years they have given us that spot so someone does not have to drive all the way to New Haven where we used to have to go and have, as you can imagine, all of a sudden you found out your child has had the sexual assault and now you've got to figure out how you're going to get all the way to New Haven and you live in the greater Bridgeport area. So we're just adding more stress. We've alleviated that now where we can have that family go right to Bridgeport Hospital. And we're very thankful for that. And with that happening, we take all this information as a team. So from medical to law enforcement to the center, and we put all of our expertise together and explore what's happened to either this little boy or young lady. Again, they're under the age of 18 years old. They can be 5 years old and up to 17. They only have to tell their story one time while it's being videotaped at the center. So these are scheduled a forensic interviewer, which are individuals that have been trained in a program called Finding Words at the Police Academy in Marion. And I will tell you that the guidance counselors that are now forensic interviewers that also are parts of our constituency have been there for anywhere from 10, 15, 20 years. And you're hearing incredible stories that really can make you extremely angry because it's hard to fathom who would do this to a child. And it's not someone that hides in a bush, not a stranger. It's someone that a child's trusted, whether it's a family member or it's someone that has worked with the child, whether it's in a recreational center. And, of course, a lot that we've read and heard in the media are being affected by children. Many adults suppressed that and didn't report it years ago. So now they're dealing with a lot of trauma as an adult. So we always encourage the family member to bring the child in, at least document it, have the child tell their story. And then what happens after that is now support group for family, a lot of support for that child.
Excellent. We've only got a few minutes left, but and we definitely want to make sure people are aware of the 21st Annual Speaking of Women Conference. It's coming up on September 25th. Folks, mark that date in your calendar. This is a really important event. Obviously, it wouldn't be happening 21 years running if it wasn't both highly attended and extremely valuable for every single person involved. But Deb, if we could really quickly just kind of give us a treetop concept of how you're serving the growing number of folks on the opposite end of the spectrum, those that are victims of elder abuse.
Well, an event like Speaking of Women is our signature event. And we always try to get a speaker that has been relevant to them and they're passionate about this type of work. So what we see is we also work with Jewish Senior Services, who are experts in working with elder abuse, and we will do representation in court with them. But the event, like Speaking of Women, the proceeds from that event all go to direct services. Once again, whether no matter what the age of someone, we sometimes forget that our beloved grandparents, and the older I get, the you know, I'm in that category of being a grandparent, and I'm very, very blessed to not have abuse in my life. But I will say that there are so many that are terrified to speak up and talk about it. So the proceeds from Speaking of Women will allow someone to get legal representation, have free counseling. Everything we do at the Center for Family Justice is free, and it's also confidential.
So this is an event that you're partnering on with People's United Bank, great friends of ours here at the station. And tell us about it and how folks can get involved and attend.
So if someone is interested in either a sponsorship or to buy a ticket and to come on September 25th, which will be held at the Waterview in Monroe, they can do two things. They can either call us at the center at 203-334-6154 and ask for our development office, which is extension 121. Or they can go on our website, which is www.centerforfamilyjustice.org, and you can sign up online and purchase your ticket.
And tell us about the program. What are people going to be doing and seeing and hearing?
We're very excited this year. Our 21st Speaking of Women signature event for Tamron Hall to be our keynote speaker. And her background will be talking about what happened to her sister, though it was never proven in a court of law. Her sister was murdered, we believe, due to domestic violence. She had been in an abusive relationship. Tamron has written a book about the scenario, but she is a very strong victims advocate regarding domestic violence and why people should talk about it if they know someone needs support to gear them, whether they're in Connecticut, Bridgeport, New York, or anywhere around the country. There is an agency like ours that can provide free and confidential services. We'll also be hearing from a client that had many years ago gone through her own experience. So I always put our client side by side with the keynote because they're it's very powerful and very brave of any client to, after the crisis, talk about what happened and now how they became a survivor.
Yeah, but also I have to believe in 21 years, each event that pairs your keynote with a survivor is followed by either people who were right there in the audience or someone that they love contacting the Center for Family Justice, because that testimony kind of kicked the brick loose that was holding up the whole process of healing.
Absolutely, John. We know 1 in 4 women will be affected by domestic violence in their lifetime. And we also know 1 in 7 men will also be affected by violence. So we know we'll be talking to someone, many, many people in that audience.
Excellent. The Center for Family Justice provides free and confidential trauma-informed services and coordinates care for victims and survivors of domestic violence, sexual violence, human trafficking, and child abuse across Bridgeport, Easton, Fairfield, Monroe, Stratford, and Trumbull. Their annual 21st annual Speaking of Women event is coming up on September 25th. To learn all about it, all the great work that they do, or most importantly, to take advantage of their services, you can go to centerforfamilyjustice.org. If you're a victim of domestic abuse, you can call them at 203-384-9559, and their sexual assault hotline with experts available 24 hours a day is 203-333-2233. Their CEO is Deb Greenwood. She's been with us to close the program this morning. Deb, thank you so much, and good luck with the event, and
you,
continued
Jim.
Good luck with the center. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for airtime in writing to me via email at john.voket, that's john.voket, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast without permission of Connoisseur Media. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scotts, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voket. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and important information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.